Welcome to episode 2 of Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Tim Friedman, along with fellow Clevelander and rock and roll expert, Frank Ost. Frankie, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Hall of Fame inductees, as we're running down the list, 2005. And we'll begin with George Buddy Guy, the Chicago blues guitarist. What'd you think of George Buddy Guy?
Definitely a blues man.
Influenced the likes of Clapton, Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimmy Page, John Mayer, and Gary Clark Jr., among others.
Absolutely. Terrific stuff. I mean, from the Chicago's blues tradition.
Still kicking today in his mid-80s. Like many, many artists, his material was destroyed in that devastating fire that Universal had in 2008 in L.A.
No, it's terrible.
So he lost a lot of his work. The OJs, the R&B group from Canton, Ohio, formed in 1958. Original names were the Mascots and then the Triumphs. There was a local DJ named Eddie OJ that decided to help him out, and they took his last name as their group name. What'd you think of the OJs, Frankie?
Love them. Boy, songs like Backstabbers. Mm-hmm. Boy, can you get any better than that? What a groove they laid down.
They worked with a guy named Frankie Crocker, who himself was a big-time DJ in New York. You may remember him as one of the first VJs on VH1.
Oh, okay.
The OJs, really good bunch of songs there. Love Train, Love Backstabbers, you know, good stuff. The Pretenders, Chrissy Hynde, James Honeyman Scott, Pete Farndon, Martin Chambers, a couple of those guys died way too young.
Yeah, I think we might have seen a lot more from that group had they not had those tragic losses.
Chrissy's been the only consistent member since then. Pete Farndon's musical influences were said to include Stanley Clarke and Jeff Beck, so that's some heady guys right there. They were a really good band. They came around a lot, like a lot of those bands did, at like Blondie, at the perfect time, didn't they?
Yeah, and she considered herself, even though she's from here in Ohio, she mm-hmm. considered herself a Brit.
Yeah.
And used to fly the English flag at the concert, so it was a very unusual type thing.
Did she have her British accent like Madonna does?
No, not at all.
Brass in pocket, kid, don't stop your sobbing, talk of the town, don't get me wrong, back in the chain gang. Private Life, good in concert too, weren't they?
And boy, she even wrote a great song about Ohio.
She did, didn't she? Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman, 1966, it went to number one. Michael Bolton recorded a nice little version of it too, which won a Grammy Award. Only 7 songs have been recorded multiple times and have both gone to number one by different artists. That's one of them.
I didn't think of that, but you're right.
When a Man Loves a Woman.
What a terrific song.
Backed up by the legendary Muscle Shoals rhythm section, which we've spoken about earlier.
From Alabama.
Yep, did a lot of work with Lynyrd Skynyrd and Bob Seger. Finally, U2, the Dublin, Ireland band. They got together in 1976 when Paul David Hewson, Bono? That's Sonny Bono.
Bono. I think it's Bono.
Age 16, got things together. Kind of like my age, you know, you would think I'd be a big U2 fan. They're okay. I like their music. I just don't love it.
Absolutely. It's funny how they kind of escaped me, too, because they should be right up my alley.
They should be. He's quite active in social causes, especially in Africa. Bono's done a lot of benefit work, a lot of benefit concerts. His philanthropic efforts all over the world will never be taken for granted or forgotten. Band members David Evans, The Edge, his brother Dick Evans, Adam Clayton, Larry Mullen Jr., Ivan McCormick. They were put in their first year of eligibility.
You know, as it should.
As they should have been. They won 22 Grammy Awards, more than any other band.
Wow.
And Bono, he collaborated with, get this list, Tom Petty, Tony Bennett, Bruce Springsteen, Green Day, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, and Frank Sinatra.
You can't get a better list than that.
Sunday Bloody Sunday, Pride in the Name of Love, With or Without You. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Great tunes, and as I said, I wish I could get with them more. I just can't. I don't know why.
Yeah, I should have seen them at least 3 times in concert and never did. And I feel bad about that. It's probably one of the holes in my rock education.
Your concert going experience.
You're absolutely right.
Do you feel that you've been cheated by it, or you feel less than?
I feel a little bit less than, yeah.
It doesn't absolutely. Keep you up at night, though.
No. I've seen a lot of rock concerts, so I think I can go without a few.
New feature, top 5 artists. We're going to call it 5 and 5. 1973, I'll give you mine, and Frankie will give you his, and some will overlap. Top 5 artists for me in 1973. Paul McCartney and Wings, Elton John, Steely Dan, Paul Simon, and Stevie Wonder. And Frankie, what are yours?
I'm totally with you on Elton John, Stevie Wonder, and Paul McCartney and Wings. They all had fantastic years with fantastic records. I'll go a little different and just go with Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin also.
Top albums of the year. Dark Side of the Moon, you liked that one, didn't you? That's one of your favorites.
I think what made it a great year for Pink Floyd was Dark Side of the Moon, when they went from basically a cult band that had a following, but nobody really knew much about them, to totally blowing the lid off everything with Dark Side of the Moon.
Their eighth studio album, released in March of that year, engineered by a guy we would know later, Alan Parsons. Recorded
Absolutely.
At the Abbey Road Studios. They actually asked Alan to do Wish You Were Here, the follow-up to that, and he said, no, I want to put together a little thing of my own, and grabbed one of the guys who worked at Abbey Road Studios named Eric Wolfson, mm-hmm. who would sing a lot of the songs on the Alan Parsons Project's albums. So off they went to their own career and Dark Side of the Moon. What do you think sets that apart from other Pink Floyd albums, or even albums from that year of 73, Frankie?
Well, I think you only get one shot at a Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, it was such a grand statement, and it all hung together so well. And not only was it, an album-oriented record that you'd listen to the whole thing, it also had hits like Money and Us and Them that could be played on any.
And it was on forever. It was on the charts forever. It lasted forever and ever.
I'm surprised it still isn't on there.
I know.
But yes, I know. It was on for literally hundreds and hundreds of weeks.
I think if you list top five albums, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road would appear on most people's favorite albums, especially if you talk about Elton John's. And his favorite, that's my album of choice for him. That double album set, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, was outstanding, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely the peak. And it was not only the peak of his sales, it was the peak of his what he put on record.
Yeah, the songwriting. Just
yes, exactly.
Perfectly.
Everything made sense. And it was a two-record set that used the two records well.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't want to take anything off of that record.
No, it was outstanding. It was just fantastic the way he did it. And the amount of work he was putting out at that time was incredible. Plus, he was touring.
Exactly. Generally doing kind of, I would say, an album and a half a year.
Yeah. Houses of the Holy. By the way, these are in no particular order, just kind of listing our top five albums. What'd you think of the Led Zeppelin Houses of the Holy?
Love that one. It was a perfect comeback after Led Zeppelin IV. Nobody thought that they could come back and put out anything close to it. And they put that record out. And although nothing could top Led Zeppelin IV, it certainly stands up in the pantheon of Led Zeppelin records.
And they weren't done yet either, were they?
Absolutely not.
They were kind of just getting warmed up.
And the other thing that made that year great for them is that they had a huge tour in 73, and a lot of that which would be used on their The Song Remains the Same soundtrack. So it was a huge year for them.
Recently, I was listening to a classic rock station here in Cleveland, and it was New Year's Eve. They were playing the Led Zeppelin live concert they did at the Coliseum. I think it was 1977.
Oh, boy.
Did you happen to see any Led Zeppelin concerts?
I saw one Led Zeppelin concert. It might have been that one. To be honest with you, it might have been that one.
Band on the Run, that was an album that carried over from 73 to 74. It had its greatest success in 74, but Paul McCartney and Wings recorded that in, what, Nigeria?
Yeah.
And then released that in the summer, late fall, right in there of 73. One of my favorites. Then Wild Innocent and the E Street Shuffle, that's Bruce Springsteen's work. What did you think of that one?
A beautiful record. It was kind of the first time here in Cleveland that we'd really heard of him. His first record, Greetings from Asbury Park, basically was bought by no one. It got no airplay. This one finally got some airplay with songs like Sandy and Rosalita. You finally started to hear a little bit about what was going on in New Jersey. And a lot of people, especially in Cleveland, were liking it.
Other top albums, 1973, David Bowie, Aladdin the Sane, that's where the Gene Genie, that was his most commercially successful album to that date. And he wrote those tunes while on tour here in the States.
Yeah, I love that album. And he wrote them for each town he was in. He actually had like a note Detroit, about panic in Detroit, and like New York on one, and Cracked Actor, of course, was L.A. So very interesting. It was kind of his take after his tour, his first big tour, the Ziggy Stardust tour. It's kind of his take on America.
Talked about the Who They Are featured artist last season, Quadrophenia. Good album, you said, but not their best.
Not their best. It brought back a lot of what had come before it. It was a little bit repetitive, although when you got a song like 515 on a record, it's still a great record.
Can't go wrong with that one.
You got it.
The Beatles all had success in 73. George Harrison, Ringo Starr, Paul McCartney and Wings, and John Lennon all had albums out. First with John, Mind Games. What'd you think?
A little bit weaker for him. A couple of good hits like Mind Games, mm-hmm. the song, and there were a couple others that I enjoyed off that. Not his strongest effort.
Paul McCartney and Wings, Red Rose Speedway, another one that was good. My Love was on there, but yeah. Not as strong, obviously, as Band on the Run, but still a good album.
Not even as strong as Venus and Mars, I think, which would follow it.
Sure. Ringo Starr had a good one. His third album, the self-titled album called Ringo, on it were Photograph, which went to number one. You Were 16. Oh My My. Good. That was what I considered a real breakout artist for him as a solo. I know he had Don't Come Easy a couple years earlier, but for me, it really solidified him as a solo performer.
And, you know, the strangest thing is, up through Ringo, he was probably the most successful charting Beatle, ex-Beatle, mm-hmm. Of them all, because both John Lennon and Paul McCartney were kind of having a little trouble getting going.
Yeah. Paul was writing songs like Give Ireland Back to the Irish.
Right.
Another Day was good, but not great. Now, Paul did have that number one with Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey in 71, but I get your point, yeah.
Ringo was able to pull three hits records off of that, and then you mentioned one of the best songs ever in the post-Beatle era, It Don't Come Easy.
That's a great tune.
Oh, yeah.
George Harrison. He had his, All Things Must Pass, and mm-hmm. he was doing his work for the concert of Bangladesh, so he was doing some good stuff, but it wasn't real high charting. My Sweet Lord and was a big hit for
him.
Yeah,
we talked about My Sweet Lord, ended up getting him into trouble.
Yeah.
Yes.
Give Me Love, number one for him, as the follow-up to All Things Must Pass, the album Living in the Material World. The original intent was to use Phil Spector, but then George decided to take over those duties himself. Phil did produce one cut from the album, though. But he had help. George did. Leon Russell, Pete Ham of Badfinger. Talking about how important those albums were, the album covers and the inside artwork of those 70s albums. This one was designed by a fellow named Tom Wilkes, who was also the art director for the Monterey Pop Festival and A&M Records back in the day.
Wow.
He designed album covers and inside work for Beggar's Banquet of the Stones, Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Neil Young's Harvest. Remember that one?
Absolutely.
Plus, he had something to do with those two really neat album covers for the Beatles' Blue and the Red albums, you know, those compilations, 67 to 70 and 62 to 66. Same location, different photographs.
Exactly, and they look so different.
ZZ Top, Tres Hombres. That's the first time that I really started getting with ZZ Top. LaGrange is on there. What you think of ZZ Top?
Love ZZ Top. Thought their original records, their first three or four records, were just rhythm and blues and just down and dirty. Nothing fancy, but very enjoyable.
Did you know their 50th anniversary edition called ZZ Top's first album did not chart, but it is available. You can download it if you want. Songs like Certified Blues and Squank, not Squonk, but Squank on there. Straight ahead, country, style, rock.
50 years ago.
Oh, ZZ Top.
Making me feel old now.
Chicago 6 came out with Just You and Me, Feeling Stronger Every Day. Chicago is one of your favorites.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a highlight for Jimmy Panko on that one.
But, yeah.
Both those records were fantastic. And the whole record was an excellent effort by them.
It was. I liked how they doled out the songwriting duties to just about everybody in the band, and even Lee Lockney had a song that he wrote, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he helmed Call on Me.
Yeah, and Jim Pankow, Pete Cetera, of course. They were all great songwriters and performers, and right at their peak, one of their peaks, I thought, was right in there.
Exactly.
They had a couple of peaks to me before they went into a different direction in the early part of the 80s.
Right.
Other albums, Jackson Browne's For Every Man, Steely Dan with My Old School, had Countdown to Ecstasy come out that year. That was a good album.
Oh, love that album.
Paul Simon, There Goes Ryman Simon, backed up by the Muscle Shoals rhythm section again. Kodachrome and Loves Me Like a Rock both hit number two in the nation. I thought Kodachrome hit number one, but I was wrong.
Well, that was a great record, and it really kind of broke him as a singles artist. He'd had a good album, Paul Simon, before
that.
Yeah,
Mother and Child Reunion.
Yeah, but this one really, really kind of blew the lid off it.
You like good instrumental music, rock instrumentals, don't you?
Absolutely.
Frankenstein was out that year, but another song that I really like, you'll find on the Field of Dreams movie when he's when Kevin Costner is going to Boston to find James Earl Jones' character, Jessica, written by Dickie Betts.
Yeah, what a fantastic one that was.
That is. And Ramblin' Man, also on the album by the Allmans Brothers and Sisters, done a couple years following the death of Duane Allman. They had put out a couple albums after that, Eat a Peach and Brothers and Sisters. Joe Walsh really broke out with The Smoker You Drink, The Player You Get, Rocky Mountain Way, and Meadows. Number six album for him that year.
Yeah, and he's you know, always been kind of part of Cleveland, Akron type person, but he's a fantastic guitar player. And, of course, he would go on to even bigger things with the Eagles.
Now, those two songs I really like. And as I've started following the James Gang and Joe Walsh more and more, you pick up an album or you download the whole thing, and there's more than just those two songs on there. You'll be surprised at the nuggets of great quality work you'll find, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And Bill Simcic was the producer, co-producer for that album as well.
Right.
One-hit wonders, you're going to find a lot of these from 1971 and earlier. The Stampeders, Sweet City Woman. Remember that one?
Oh, I do.
The Canadian trio enjoyed much more success there with over a half dozen songs charting and charting high in our friends up north. Songs like Wild Eyes, which was number two for them a year later in Canada, Minstrel Gypsy, and Hit the Road Jack, both hitting number six. It Hit the Road Jack would do no better than number 40 here. Sweet City Woman. That's a cool little song, isn't it?
It's a nice song. Little earworm. And I just remember it. What brings it back is a
little banjo.
Houlihan and Big Chuck played it for years as one of their bump music. And it was really fun.
It's a fun song, a great way to kind of round out summer of 71, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
The Jaggers, led by the Cleveland favorite Donnie Iris. The American rock band from Pittsburgh had a big hit in 1970 with something called The Rapper.
That's a fun tune. Mm-hmm. I really like that one.
Made it to number two in the early part of 70. Yet their follow-up single called I Call My Baby Candy could only muster a peak of number 75 that year.
Yeah, and we didn't hear much from the Jaggers after that.
We did hear from Donnie Iris with Aliyah and Love Is Like a Rock.
Great tunes.
Here's a segment we'll bring back from time to time on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations called Whatever Happened To. And Frankie, remember the group Lighthouse, the Canadian band?
I definitely remember them. They come from the same kind of blood, sweat, and tears, Chicago type orchestrations.
As you said many times, anything with horns you're listening to.
You better believe it.
Strings, same vein as Chicago and blood, sweat, and tears. One Fine Morning was number 24 in the fall of 71. They performed live at Carnegie Hall in 1972.
I didn't realize that.
Pretty Lady hit the charts in the fall of 73. That was a minor hit here, but I remember they played a lot of it here at Wixie.
Mm-hmm.
It did hit number 58 here, which was not great, but it did hit the top 10 in Canada. No surprise from a band from Toronto. They disbanded in the mid-70s only to reunite with new members, and they still tour today.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
A guy named Howard Shore, who played saxophone, went on to become the music director for Saturday Night Live. And then Bob McBride, another member, became a top session singer, but died in 1998. Nine members were also deceased, including co-founder Skip Prokop. After Lighthouse, he turned his attention to a radio broadcasting career Skip did prior to his death at age 73. So they did other stuff, maybe not gigantic money-making stuff, but... And sometimes they did it in the music industry. Paul Hoffert, another member, was not only an accomplished musician, but also an expert in technology, becoming one of the inventors of the algorithms for MP3 technology.
Wow.
So you never know where a guy's career is going to take him. We talked about Jeff Skunk Baxter, how he's doing work for the Department of Defense.
That's right. You were telling me that.
You know, and some of these guys are developing MP3 technology, which we're using today, and people didn't know what they were talking about in like 1999. But here we are.
When I think about, we were talking about the last show about how you think groups should have done different records. Well, that one was one that Chicago should have done.
Yeah. And once in a while, artists will say, I wish I'd written that song.
Exactly.
Or that's a perfect song for me. Or, mm-hmm. And that's a real testament to how great that song was. And the live version, if you get a chance to download it, if you don't already have it, it's like 6 minutes long or something. Radio edited it down to like 4 minutes, but either one is good. I like the long version better.
Absolutely.
Outstanding song, Lighthouse, in the Whatever Happened To segment. Some of these artists, it's kind of sad where things ended up for them. So many of them have passed away, but that's not unusual since it's the early 70s we're talking about, or late
sure.
70s. It's nice to see how they go on to other things. A lot of them are famous producers, maybe not in pop music or rock music. A lot of them have moved down to Nashville or something and have become huge songwriters or
exactly.
producers down there. So you may not hear of them in the mainstream, but they're still doing their thing, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are still getting together with reunion tours and whatnot as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Featured artist this time around, I wanted to get to it early in season two, David Bowie, one of the best-selling artists of all time, originally known as David Jones, but we already had a Davy Jones back then, didn't we, Frankie?
That's right.
In the U.S., 5 platinum albums, 9 golds, much more than that in the U.K., innovative songwriter, performer, actor.
And yet underrated, I think, overall.
I do, too. Passed away just a couple of days after his 69th birthday on January 10th, 2016. He released that album, entitled Black Star. His 25th studio album was released just a couple of days before his death, recorded mostly in private, with his friend and longtime producer Tony Visconti. He influenced glam rock, punk rock, dance and soul. His record company stated it perfectly with the slogan, there's old wave, there's new wave, and then there's David Bowie.
That's great.
Did you ever see him in concert?
Yes, luckily enough, I saw him twice in concert. What a show he puts on.
David Bowie, 67. Then David Bowie, Man of Worlds, Man of Music in the U.S. is what it was called. Featuring Space Oddity. Now everything in 69 was space, wasn't it?
That's right.
And then you would have other space songs in the early 70s, like Spaceman by Nielsen and mm-hmm. Rocketman. Even the song by, what was it called, Billy Preston, Spaced Out, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Out of Space.
Out of Space. Out of Space. The Man Who Sold the World, 1970. Hunky Dory, 71. People started getting with David Bowie in the Ziggy Stardust persona. The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust was 1972. Aladdin Sane, 73, every year.
Incredible. Boy, you're talking about my youth.
Yeah. Every year. Do you have all these albums? Some of them?
Pretty much all of them.
When was the first time you started hearing and getting with David Bowie, do you think?
I'd heard of Space Oddity, but it was the Hunky Dory album mm-hmm. was the first one that I heard played in Cleveland. And that really started my interest in him. And, of course, Ziggy Stardust, which was next, kind of blew the lid off the whole thing.
Pinups, 1973. Diamond Dogs, that's when I first started getting with David Bowie. Now, by then, he had already had so many other songs that I would get to know with the Changes One Bowie album, that
right.
compilation album.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, this is good stuff.
What a terrific greatest hits album that is.
Yeah, Suffragette City and mm-hmm. Rebel Rebel and so many great tunes. He's released so many compilation albums over the years, but that's the one that I really wanted in my collection when I first started getting albums and stopped collecting singles so much.
Right.
Young Americans, 1975, still putting something out every year, didn't he? The title cut and Fame. Station to Station, 1976. He had Low, then Heroes, Lodger, Scary Monsters, moving into the 80s,
yep.
The Nile Rodgers produced Let's Dance. Never did slow down, did some films, released the Ziggy Stardust, the motion picture movie, which was filmed during his Stardust tour of 73, but it wasn't released for another 10 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last using his Ziggy persona. He acted in 30 motion pictures and television shows.
I never realized
and stage
that.
Productions, yeah. He just did so much. And who hasn't seen his work with Bing Crosby at Christmas time? And
one of my favorites.
I still don't think Bing Crosby quite knew who he was or what was going on.
I'm sure he had no idea.
but he made him feel right at home, didn't he, behind
yeah,
the piano?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that's something that today's youth, you're probably used to seeing the generations, but boy, back then, that was something totally different.
Totally different.
Nobody who watched that show will ever forget it.
And I guess the story goes, David didn't want to sing, little drummer boy, so they whipped up a little thing for him to sing on his own, and it meshed perfectly with the little drummer boy.
Right,
Peace
exactly.
On Earth. Before David's death, they were talking about bringing it back as David being the Bing Crosby character and maybe a younger artist. I don't know who they would get. Justin Timberlake comes to mind, maybe Jay-Z, Nicki Minaj, somebody like that, you know. Or maybe somebody who's a little off the beaten path, like David Bowie certainly was with the glam rock in 1970. I don't know who they would have gotten to play his role, but it would have been interesting to see how they would have pulled that off.
Absolutely. That would have been fun.
Bing Crosby was the kind of guy that made you feel at home, even if he had just met you. It looked like he was a fun guy to know and a welcoming kind of persona, at least on stage.
Yes, he brought that off terrifically.
So David did those films, and he did the onstage work. He was also a painter and an art collector. He worked with different producers over the years. We mentioned Nile Rodgers and Tony Visconti, also Harry Maslin, who would help mold his dance tracks like Fame, and that featured John Lennon. You know, we talked about how John was doing some things with other artists and like Elton John.
Exactly.
So Maslin is a Philly product and engineered big hits like Mandy, and then came You, as well as hits from Air Supply and the Bay City Rollers. So Mr. Maslin, Harry Maslin, who worked with those guys, also worked with Bowie. Quite a diverse career, wouldn't you say?
Exactly.
David moved to New York in 1974 before hitting the coast out west, began looking into different kinds of music like soul and funk, and launched the Diamond Dogs Tour here in the U.S. and North America. And he didn't just do a couple of dates either. He was on stage and on tour for a long, long time. Came to Cleveland for a couple of dates at Public Hall in June 74. And one of the very early dates on that long tour, he'd make a return trip to Cleveland the following November, just before wrapping things up in Atlanta to start, the start of December. So he was on tour for like a year or more.
Exactly.
I don't know how they do it. That tour called the Serious Moonlight Tour, which we discussed, 1983, featured a set of very recognizable songs. His fans wanted to hear more of his familiar stuff, apparently, so he complied. The tour kicked off in Brussels and finished in Hong Kong. So he came here for just one night after that three-night performance the night before, a couple of nights before Madison Square Garden. So he had that high of performing in New York, and he had the Modern Love and China Girl and all the other hits from that album. Now, the 1984 album, Tonight, featuring Blue Jean, not a bad album. What'd you think?
Excellent follow-up. Didn't sell quite as well, but David Bowie was never about sales figures. He was about moving on.
Did his own thing, didn't he?
He did, and he was always trying to change. He was always looking for a new sound, and that's pretty much what he did there.
He did not play any instruments on any of the tracks. He didn't even do a follow-up tour. In fact, he didn't have another tour until the Glass Spider Tour in 1987, and then the Sound and Vision Tour came to the Coliseum for two dates in the summer of 90. Did you happen to catch any of those?
I think it was the Sound and Vision Tour that I saw.
1990.
Like I said, he never stood in the same place. He always was moving on. I think he easily could have done Ziggy Stardust for 10 years, but he chose to move it on.
He was a very interesting character, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And then he went through a time period where he did his Berlin trilogy with Lowe and Heroes and The Lodger. And Heroes is one of my favorite records. It's mm-hmm. just we've all heard the song Heroes, of course, but the album behind it is fun, too.
So, Frankie, it won't be too long until a tribute album comes out honoring David Bowie. There will be current artists adding their own special spin to a lot of David Bowie's greatest songs, like Heroes and The Man Who Sold the World, Sound and Vision, and Space Oddity. It's called Modern Love, and it's due to come out in May.
Really?
Yeah, it should be some good listening. You know, I love David Bowie's music, but back in the 70s, especially during that Ziggy Stardust era, I just didn't know what to make of him. I thought it was kind of weird.
Yeah, exactly. You had these songs, especially from Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane, that came off like the Rolling Stones. I mean, they came off rough and tumble, let's put it that way. It was not easy to listen to music. And yet you had this character that seemed androgynous and seemed so different than what the music was laying down. And I also didn't know what to make of that. And I was a little bit too young to actually go to those concerts, to go to those shows at that time. I didn't see him till later on when it was kind of got an old hat at that time.
You know, you'd see an artist like him and Ziggy Stardust or something, and you'd think he's a weird dude. I can't listen to his music. But then, lo and behold, you put it on the turntable and you loved it.
And it was totally different from the vibe you were getting off the album cover.
So exactly. Those, back then, album covers were big, weren't they?
They were huge, and they were pretty much one of the biggest ways that the artist communicated with his fan base.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, because you would open up the album, you'd see pictures of them. There might be a poster in there. There might be liner notes, lyrics, that kind of thing, and tell you where that stuff came from and what was going on the record.
So album covers were big in the 70s.
Huge.
People who were graphic artists, there wasn't, you know, music videos, and certainly wasn't social media like there is today. Tiger Beat magazine, I don't really think the album covers and the stuff in the album you would read and just kind of follow along when the album was on. It was very important, wasn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. That's how you learn the music. That's how you learn the lyrics. Yeah, that's how you found out about the guy.
David's music was very adaptable. I think he would have fit in any era. Even in the doo-wop generation, he would have found a way to work with Danny and the Juniors or Little Anthony and the Imperials, Randy and the Rainbows, the Del Vikings, and it would have sounded great, wouldn't it?
That is for sure.
Next time around, our featured artist will be Marvin Gaye. Talk about a smooth-sounding voice we have in the past mentioned. Guys like Robert Palmer and Brian Ferry of Roxy Music. Marvin Gaye, to me, is the coolest of the cool. Wouldn't you say, Frankie?
Just a fantastic voice, and what a career he had.
And he liked working with other artists as well, didn't he? Tammy Terrell, Kim Weston, Diana Ross, even the Temptations and the Spinners did some backing vocals for him. So, like David Bowie, he liked working with other people. He's a very giving artist, and we'll talk a lot about Marvin Gaye as our featured artist next time around on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. For Frank Ost, I'm Tim Friedman. We'll see you next time.